Welcome to Holyrood Unganged, the Lorna Slater of political podcasts. Well, we're back with a bang, obviously, but we had our episode just after the new year there, after a wee Christmas hiatus. We then took a kind of unscheduled one. My colleague Deborah was a bit under the weather, so she's going to do it. And last week, I turned 40, so I was too busy drowning in my own self-pity and tears to do the podcast. But, you know, now that I'm a mature gentleman, I've, you know, sorted myself out, composed myself, and I'm back to deliver this wonderful political content that you're grown accustomed to. So we talked about what we hope is the last days of the Boris regime, as news of yet another Downing Street party against lockdown rules comes out. I genuinely don't know how many parties that is. If it more parties than I have when there's no lockdown, which I don't know if that says more about my social life or theirs, but we'll just leave it with that. Yeah. So we checked our phones as soon as we come off the podcast, hoping to find that Boris had fallen on his own sword, but he continues to hang on. We also spoke about the fact that as of 2027, there'll be no more TV licence, changing the tradition of public service broadcasting in the UK forever. Kind of hard to feel sorry for the BBC after everything they've done to, you know, progressive politics in our movement, but we try to see it from a more wider angle. And then we spoke about the current state of the Labour Party, where Tories are welcome and socialists are not. And then we finished up discussing the attacks on Lorna Slater for having the gall to ask for a day off. So, without any further ado, let's get ungagged. And it was nice to hear you smile. Dream a dream, cause you'll never die. The stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice to hear you smile. Hello and welcome, listeners, to another episode of Holyrood Unguided. I'm your host, David McClement, broadcasting from the Blantyre Free State. And joining me, as ever, are my two faithful comrades. We have the digital Michelangelo of Mulgay. It's Miss Deborah Torrance. Hi, Deborah.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Hello. How are you doing? Nice to see you.
And also, we have the Pizza Hut Prince of Falkirk. It is Mr. Brian Finlay.
Hello, hello. How are you all doing? Nice to be back.
As we closed down for a weekend of Christmas break and we came back with one episode, and then we had a kind of unscheduled break. Deborah was a bit under the weather and I had a kind of mental breakdown about turning 40. So I needed a few days to recover. I'm back fighting, well, not quite fighting fit, but fighting 40.
Were you actually on a bender?
Not really.
No.
I did get a wee bit tipsy on Friday because it was my best pal's 40th as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a private dining at a nice restaurant in Bothwell.
Ooh.
And even better, him and his good wife were picking up the bill. So I was absolutely wrecked. Wrecked in charge of four reins. It was not a pretty sight. Luckily, my wife was sober and driving. So,
well, happy birthday, David.
All worked out fine. Thank you very much. Well, we just get started then. Get back to the politics.
Right into the politics.
We blethered so much in the last pod. I feel that we should just dive right in.
Right into
the chase. Mm-hmm. So as it stands, Boris Johnson, at time of recording, is still the Prime Minister. It's seemingly been his final days for at least a month, maybe 6 weeks. Somehow, in a kind of Trumpian act of survival, he is clinging on. Despite the fact we have an MP, my MP actually, is in trial for breaking COVID rules. We had senior doctors in Scotland resigning for a breach of COVID rules. But we have an unending list of parties and rule breaking coming out of Downing Street, and as of yet none of it seems to be enough to cost Boris Johnson his job. And the latest, I believe, is that Boris had a birthday party in lockdown complete with cake, candles and 30 guests. So I'm crossing my fingers that that's the final straw and he'll be gone soon, but I'm not betting my mortgage on it. Thoughts, Brian?
Yeah, like you said, I mean, these Downing Street parties have just been bubbling away, really, haven't they, for the last month. We've got the much anticipated Sue Gray report, which is the name that I think people have heard most over the last week. Sue Gray this, Sue Gray that, Sue Gray's report. But I think when it comes to the Sue Gray report, I think it would be really good to make sure that we can see all of what Sugri's had to say, because I don't think that's going to be the case. I think there'll be, I think a lot of evidence will be omitted from that, and I think it will just be like a nice little one pager that we'll get to read about that. So that's nice of them, you know, so we don't have to read all the details, because, you know, because it's not really that important, is it really? But yeah, Boris Johnson, June 2020, despite the rules, social distancing that was still in place and, you know, having to meet people outdoors and all these types of things, you know, apparently, allegedly, had a party for his birthday. It lasted around half an hour. There was about 30 people present. Carrie Johnson surprised him with a birthday cake. I really don't think you can cover that one up as being a work event. But yeah, it just seems to be constant unraveling of like Christmas parties, birthday parties, cheese and wine and drinks after work and quizzes and all this kind of stuff. And I think the Conservatives have plummeted in support in the polls, so much that Labour, not just any Labour leader, Keir Starmer is 10 points ahead. So that just shows you how bad things are, just to put that in context. So I think the Tories are basically just as much as anybody else trying to get rid of Boris Johnson at the moment. He's a complete liability to the Conservative Party at the moment, which is great for us on the left and for exposing a lot of the nastiness of the Conservative Party. But I think, and we've said this before, the reason this sticks in people's throats is because it impacts on everybody directly. Okay, so everybody can relate to last May, last June, you know, it was my birthday, June 2020. My partner was self-isolating with his mum. Basically, they were shielding for a whole 3 months. I didn't see my partner for 3 months. I was on my own in Dundee. I didn't know anybody else there. Couldn't leave the council area to go and visit anybody, and spent my birthday alone. And that's nothing compared to what a lot of people suffered. But it really, when you read these kind of things and reflect on them, it makes you really, really frustrated, because you're just like, you know what? It makes you feel like a mug when you weren't being a mug. You were just following public health advice. But I think this is why it sticks in so many people's throats. It will be the end of Boris Johnson, but I really hope it comes around soon before the polls start to creep back up again. And we've had a poll today where the Tories have gone up 4 points. So,
is that even possible?
So I just hope that the Sugri report comes out, the opposition parties, all opposition parties, get in there and basically get this Prime Minister gone before it's forgotten about.
The Sugri report is, you know, Boris Johnson apparently gets to review it and decide what goes into it after before the public see it. So it's like, it should just be the Boris Johnson report.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's gonna let us know. Once he's been let known, if he's been there, and then he'll let us know what he wants us to know. That's the Sugri report.
Yeah, I mean, like, they've been trying to hide behind this, the fact that a report's gone on to no comment. I can't remember what minister it was, but she was getting questioned, and they said, you know, was the Prime Minister at this party? And she's like, well, we don't know. We have to wait for the Sugri report to come back. And they said, were you at the party? She says, like I said, we'll have to wait. And she went, surely you know if you were there or not. She just wouldn't answer. I'm looking forward to the Sugri report just to check whether I was there.
Yeah, just to clear up that we weren't definitely in London.
Just in case, I don't know. I mean, Sugri might come back and say, no, that we were all there. In which case, we need to reflect on that.
Well, she's also going to have to take into account, was Boris Johnson at the birthday party, and did Carrie Johnson burst out of the cake? Was that the surprise? It is a bit like we are kind of now joking about it, and I think you're right, that the urgency of time in dealing with this, it's very, you know, a small window, because if he gets away with long enough, then he's rode it out, hasn't he? So what, when you just bumble along like he usually does? I don't know, I'm starting to think he might survive it. Like, I've asked about 4 Twitter polls in the last month. Will Boris Johnson resign? Not should he, will he? And everyone's came back like, nah, nah, nah. And I think Twitter's right. Highly scientific poll, obviously. But I just think that Keir Starmer isn't challenging him really on it. Like, he's just going to get away with it, isn't he?
I think he has called for him to resign now, as well.
He has, yeah.
Yeah,
It took a while.
Yeah, Douglas Ross called for Boris to resign before Keir Starmer did.
Yes, that's right, yeah. But, I mean, the only reason that Douglas Ross done that was because we've got local elections coming in May. Exactly. Boris Johnson is not popular in Scotland. He's never been popular in Scotland. And I think that he is a liability, particularly to the Scottish Tories. And this is just going to be the end of the road for you know, people that might think, you know, I'm going to vote Scottish Tories because I believe in the union. I want to say no to NDRF2 via my council vote, you know, like people like that. But I think that this would actually put them off voting for the Tories. And Douglas Ross is trying to reserve some of that.
He's probably gone for councillor, let's be honest. He needs another job.
He does. He's council, MSP, MP, full sweep. Well done, pal.
There is a plus side to the silver lining that if Boris does hang on, we will get to look forward to the very public punishment beating that the Tories will dish out to Douglas Ross for daring to step out of line. We got a wee taste of it when it was Michael Gove and Jacob Rees-Mogg both sort of came out and absolutely slapped Douglas Ross about his... as being a kind of nobody and a lightweight, no importance, a lightweight. Yeah. What was the?
They said Alistair Jack was more senior, and then Alistair Jack was on to, yes, I suppose I am more senior, but I wouldn't say Douglas Ross is a lightweight. Like, what would you say, Alistair?
Is that what Alistair Jack sounds like? Because I have no idea. I've seen the guy's face, but I couldn't tell you what his voice sounds like.
He sounds like a Scottish Jacob Rees-Mogg, like he's very posh. Or it's got a lot of marbles on his mouth.
It was like a posh Sean Connery.
Was it?
Yeah. It was actually, yeah. It's good that we can laugh about this because I think you really have to because it's just so ridiculous. And we are really in Trump territory here where, you know, if this was in America, we would be thinking, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, like, oh my goodness, like, what is going on over there? This is nuts. But it's actually happening here. But what is happening, it's happening with people who are got a bit more public relations and a little bit more Britishness around them, where they're not being as, you know, really upfront about just how ridiculous this is. But it's just, it's a real shame. And I've been saying this since December. It'll be so sad that if it's, you know, Boris Johnson thinking he can get away with having parties that gets rid of him rather than his absolutely horrendous and vile policies of this Conservative government since 2010, that eventually, you know, gets rid of the current Prime Minister and quite likely completely removes the Tories from power, that it will be their own attitude where they think they're better than the rules don't apply to them, they're better than everybody else, and you guys need to follow the rules and we can do whatever the hell we want. That it's that horribleness about conservatism that would get rid of them, but not penalising vulnerable people, disabled people, queer people, you know, working class people. It's just so frustrating. But going back to what I said at the start, this is why it might be something like that that gets rid of them, because it impacts on absolutely everybody. And that's just sad.
It is quite Trump-like, the sort of scale of it, in the sense that it reminds me a wee bit of an Eddie Izzard joke when he talked about how people can't deal with death in a certain scale. He says, like, if you kill one person, you get sent to jail. Mm-hmm. Kill 10 people, you get sent to a mental institution. But if you kill, like, a million people, it's just a case that it's like, oof. Well done. Well, you must get up very early in the morning, because it's just a scale that people can't comprehend. This is what the Tories are like with the parties. Mm. One party, everybody was furious. Mm. Two parties, again, they were furious. I genuinely don't know how many parties we're talking about now. It's about 17. And when you get 17 parties, people are just kind of like, fair enough. Well done, you know.
And it's like literally got to the stage where it's like, oh, there's another one, or
yeah.
Oh, like people don't know the order, but to their credit, and I don't say this very often, was the BBC News, was it on the Sunday show? Was it not this Sunday, the Sunday before, that they actually done like a 5-minute piece of all the parties in chronological order and what the images and the accusations were and all that kind of stuff. And it's really quite a fascinating watch, that just actually how ridiculous this has actually become. And it's true what you're saying, like if it had just centred around that one Christmas party where people had a net, you know, suitcases of booze going in and all this kind of stuff, like people would be absolutely furious about it. But now it's just every day, like, oh, breaking news, ITV's got another video of someone being steaming in the garden at Downing Street, and there was, like, you know, swings were broken and all these types of things. And now it's just like, when's it going to end? Because
it just became sort of white noise.
Yes,
and
the sad thing is the whole party, the whole response, everything, it really highlights the entitlement and their total ineptitude as well, because they should have known better. Like, there should have been some sort of wee guy sitting there saying, is this really a good idea to put out this email? Like, to think that there was nobody in the staff that had a critical eye that went, this isn't really what we should be doing. And I think that the response, that entitlement, that's what's really getting stuck under people's craws. Like, I really think, I'm hoping that they want to get away with it, but as you say, it's white noise here. We are laughing about it. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? When this is a real serious breach of COVID rules, and as David says, I'm no fan of Margaret Ferrier, but she's been, you know, is she being prosecuted?
She was up in court recently.
The Tories should be done, in theory, theoretically, if you consider everything they've done, all their policies, all the, you know, horrible, heinous attitudes to migrants, to disabled people, to welfare recipients. Don't forget the two-child cap on benefits. Don't forget the benefits cap. Don't forget the lies about the cost of living isn't rising that much, when, in fact, I'm sure we're going to talk about it in a wee bit, it is. So all these things, everything should be... It should be signed, sealed, delivered. They're done. Snap to general election, but it's no happening. Because it's implicit. Like, how many ministers are implicit in it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing, I feel it's important that it goes, because otherwise they will genuinely, and they'll be right, to think that they can get away with anything. Mm-hmm. So it is important that I think he faces punishment for this. If anything, just to make the next Tory Prime Minister think twice. Because it'll not get any better, because he'll just be replaced with, as the trajectory is going, somebody even worse. You know, you look at the last few Tory Prime Ministers, and every time we think we've hit the rock bottom, you know, Boris waddles out and, you know, shows us there's 53 feet of shit below rock bottom. So who knows who will get next. But I think it's still important that he goes, because otherwise there's just no consequences, and we're no living in we're no living in a democracy. Of course, what will then happen is we'll get some new horror in, and the media will convince us we've had a change of government, yes. Even though the cabinet will still be 90% folk that attended the birthday party and was getting steaming at these parties, that they'll get a new front man. And,
yeah.
And before we know it, the polls will bounce back in the polls.
And just the last thing that I want to say on that, because I think that this message is really important, particularly for the media and particularly for people who are campaigning against the Tory government, is to say, call out these people who defended Boris Johnson.
Yep.
People like that want to be the next leader, Rishi Sunak, Liz Truss, and all these, Priti Patel, Nadine Doris,
Jacob Rees-Mogg,
all these people that want to be, they're only doing it to preserve their own jobs, because there is, if you end up with somebody, and, you know, if you end up with a Tory who wants to try and rebrand the Tory brand, get rid of some of the more extreme, they're all extreme, but the more extreme people like Priti Patel, and try and, you know, go on a massive way of trying to make the Tories look nice again, they're all going to lose their jobs in cabinet. So, you know, they're only doing it to save their own skins. And it's really uncomfortable and horrible to watch. But they threw their weight behind Boris Johnson, and they need to be held accountable for that as well. And even if they try and go for leadership again, you know, oh, it wasn't me who was the Prime Minister. It's still the same government. At the moment, it's still the same cabinet. And they are complicit in all of these horrible policies that the Tories have put forward, but also in defending Boris Johnson for basically doing the indefensible.
Right, they circled their wagons.
Yeah,
they're the ones
that, so. In pure cringe way doing it as well, because there is no way that Boris Johnson, in my opinion, is going to survive this, or at least get back up to, you know, being that popular, great Prime Minister that he was before. And they've put their weight behind him and probably done themselves more damage for their career. And I think that's great.
Yeah.
And Rishi Sunak was a bit sort of...
Mm-hmm.
Every support he gave was quite coded, so that mm-hmm. he could walk it back if he needed to. And he also kind of went missing. Nobody knew where he was. He was avoiding the cameras.
Yep.
Somebody like Nadine Doris, who probably would never get a job.
Ever.
Like, by anybody else, like, who... would likely be out of the cabinet altogether if a new Prime Minister came in, even a Tory one. You know, she was like throwing herself in front of the media bullets, like, I don't know what.
Kevin
Costner.
Well, never trust a Tory. There is your lesson learned.
Exactly. Never trust a Tory. Don't even vote Tory. And let's, like, get
Don't
Scotland
feel sorry for a Tory.
Yeah, don't feel sorry for a Tory. Don't stand in solidarity with a Tory. And, you know, if you join the... What is the great thing that I've seen on Twitter quite a lot about it? It's like the don't vote for the face-eating leopard party. And oh, I got... my face has been eaten by a leopard. It's literally like that thing where it's like, you know, the Tories are the Tories. You know, that they're not there to support vulnerable people. They're not there to support people of colour. They're not there to support queer people. They're not there to create a fantastic bussing economy that's going to support people. And when you get shat on and you're a minority, then what did you do that for?
It's that bicycle meme, isn't it? where he's cycling along, sticks a, oh, I voted Tory, sticks a stick in his front wheel.
Exactly. So that's why Scotland should not be in the Union. So we don't have to sit up with the Tories anymore.
I would also say don't show empathy for a Tory because they'll not understand what it is anyway.
Well, they will do because it's happened to them. If they need empathy for something, they'll only understand it if it's happened to them.
Well, seeing as we mentioned Nadine Dorries, I think we should go on to talk about the TV licence.
Okay.
Nadine Dorries, who is the culture secretary, confirmed that the Conservative have a plan to abolish the TV licence and it would be frozen at £159 until April 2024 and abolished altogether by 2027. I think this was kind of... This seemed a bit like a policy that has been fast-tracked to divert some headlines away from the previous stuff that we mentioned, but...
Yeah, I think.
It's a pretty big kind of change, you know, the end of public service broadcasting, basically. Deborah?
Well, I was just interested that there's... I couldn't find any, like, serious statistics on who pays the TV licence just now. Because... as far as I can see, everybody I know doesn't pay it. I'm not grassing anybody in, just saying that they're either exempt because they're old or they have had trouble setting up a direct debit or something. I don't know. But most people I speak to are like, I don't pay the TV licence. So I wanted to know, is it they've just went, oh, well, it's costing us more money to try and chase this up rather than just work off the grants we're getting anyway for the government?
I pay it.
Do you? Well done for you.
Because I don't want to go to jail.
Fair enough.
How are they going to catch you?
By listening to this podcast.
Junior has an exemption. I just want to say that. But they were talking about scrapping that, like scrapping the old people's license. So you're right, this is a very much let's just get rid of the license fee. And I think you're right, it's a diversion.
It's so difficult for people who should be supportive of public broadcasting in the face of what the BBC has become and how it is as an institution and how it's used as an arm of the government. And, you know, I mean, there's loads to talk about within that, you know, even just really contemporary real issues where you've got people at the top of the BBC who give money to the Conservative Party. You've got the BBC withdrawn from Stonewall schemes and all this kind of stuff. And do you know what? It's so difficult to do this. But I mean, the way it's funded and the TV licence is really regressive, right? Okay, so, you know, that again is another discussion. So it's so difficult to try and speak positively about this. However, I don't think that if anybody on the left thinks that getting rid of a public broadcaster and then throwing it to somebody like Murdoch is going to make our media any better, I think that would be quite ill-advised to think like that. But at the same time, if we're going to have a public broadcaster, we need to have it ripped out from the inside out and actually made to represent the electorate and the country that it's been designed to represent. And that can go, whether it be regional, whether it be, you know, national things like for Scotland and for Wales and really devolving broadcasting and all these types of things. There's so much that needs to be done in the way that the UK is formed at the moment. But I just don't think that, you know, ripping up the council tax, you know, trying to privatise the BBC or completely ending the BBC as it is or whatever it looks like, just isn't the way for us to have a better, more critical media.
Well, I really like the BBC services that we have. I listen to BBC Sounds a lot on my devices. My ma loves the news. She puts that on first thing in the morning. I just think that, for example, on BBC Radio Scotland this morning, which is meant to be a bit parochial anyway because it's, you know, regional, but but some of the callers this morning talking about Scottish independence, I was like, oh, I voted aye last time and now I'm voting no because I hate Nicola Sturgeon. It's like, what? And it's like, who vets these callers? So some of the editorial decisions are what I always have brought into question, because I know people who have worked at at BBC, I'm sure you do too, Brian, you have colleagues there, and what we see in output, and especially when it's political, is not representative of their attitudes, as far as I'm aware.
No.
So, as you say, the heat honchos that are doing the donations to the Tory party, that's where we have to be looking. And that's why I think it's really interesting why I can't really find definitive information about who is, like, how well paid is the TV licence anyway? Could you find any of that? That's what I want to know. Could you find any definitive information about that?
No, but in fairness, I never would.
I try and prepare for these podcasts, David. I take them very seriously.
Well, I think this is the combination, a very long-term plan that the right have been conducting for decades. You know, they always hated the BBC. They always say that it had a kind of left-wing bias.
Yep.
It had a reality bias, which happened to, you know, favour the left because the left wasn't telling lies. And they didn't like it because the BBC explained things to people, you know, whereas they wanted to just have their voice as the only one. And that's why they always hated the BBC. Mm-hmm. But what they've done is the BBC has been infiltrated at so many levels by not just like Tories, but like people that seem to really lean far right.
Yes.
You know, you look at the stuff about like Question Time.
Yeah.
About them repeatedly searching out and planting, you know, extreme right-wing people in the audience. And I don't know if it was always about, I don't know, it wasn't all about some grand plan. It was like tied up with getting kind of clickbaity type, you know, things where you'd get clips to go viral and just that kind of general degeneration of the kind of wider media and sort of tabloid headlines. And what they've done now is they've managed to alienate and spit in the face of everybody that would actually defend the public service broadcaster.
Yeah.
Well, for example, the next Question Time is taking place in London on February the 3rd. And they're seeking to speak to those who have declined the COVID vaccine and they want to share their views. Now, what do you think that Question Time is going to be like? First of all, getting a bunch of unvaccinated people into a studio isn't very public health conscious, is it? Like, what the fuck are they doing?
Why you're not getting them to wear a mask?
I know. Why are they hosting right-wing conspiracy nonsense? Like, what is that? Is it are they following a sort of Fox News line? They're going to be reporting on Pizzagate next. Although, sorry, just to be clear, the British Pizzagate is to do with Woking, Pizza Express, Woking. And
I thought it was about Poppy Pizzas.
Not but... oh, Poppy Pizzas, no. Could be either.
Callback to a previous podcast.
I like that. It was good. No, but seriously, why are they hosting that? What is that about?
I was generally shocked because, I mean, I watch Question Time every week because I don't have enough stress in my life. I like, you know, when it cuts to like, we're going to be in such and such next week, and normally you're just like, oh, that's nice. And I was like, even I was shocked that that was the call, that was the casting call. We speak to people that are not vaccinated. And I was like, well, first of all, if I was
maybe
a crew
it's a
member,
trick. Maybe it's a trick maybe... to get them in and get vaccinated.
But I think is that, you know, getting all these unvaccinated people together, you know, to come in and air their views and whatever their perspective and stuff is, that's the cast, the crew, that's their working environments. And actually putting them at risk is completely unacceptable. And I don't think, you know, a public broadcaster who is accountable, I say that in inverted commas, to the public is actually allowing their workers to be left in that situation, I think is completely unacceptable. And if they're going to allow people to air these views that against the vaccine, their concerns, their legitimate concerns, or whatever you want to frame it as, well, they should make sure that there's a fact checker and there's actually medical people on the panel to call out where these people have basically been duped.
I don't know if it was in response to this, but a senior BBC executive was asked, would you platform flat earthers? And the response was, well, if enough people believed in it, then they would. And you're like,
no.
Why would you do that? It doesn't matter how many people believe the Earth is flat. It's still fucking round. I think it is an example of just how debased the BBC has become to the point that, you know, it doesn't seem like something MD really wants to fight to save. Or the people that would be their allies are completely alienated from it.
Is that not a ploy? But it's the same as the NHS. Now, like, what's starting to happen? The NHS parts of it are being privatised. And, you know, this is omitting COVID completely, but basically run down. Remember in 2017, there was a humanitarian crisis in the NHS in England because they had been starved of the resources they needed. And this is where people start to say, oh, the NHS can't cope. And, oh, maybe we need to move away from this one size fits all. It doesn't really work that way, blah, blah, blah. That's a conservative right wing tactic where you grind down, you know, universal public services to the point where they can't function anymore. I say that in very commas. So then people are like, well, maybe we need to look at something else. Social housing is another example of all these great communal free to access services that are just run down, where people are like, oh, maybe, you know, we need to move with the times, you know, things
British
are changing.
British Telecom,
all of these different things. And basically, you're being completely duped, and just don't fall for it. Because the NHS, if it's given the correct resources and basically allowed to do what it should be doing, is going to be more than fine. It's a great institution. We've seen that where there's issues in Scotland and there's issues in Wales. However, we can see that where there's money put into these services, that it functions a lot better. And, you know, again, it's similar to the BBC thing where I'm like, you know what, the NHS does need reviewed, and, you know, look at senior management and how it's functioning and all these different things, right? But we can say that about any organization. But it's when it comes to the BBC, like, it's not just throwing it to the wolves and saying, yeah, it needs to be privatized, you know, get advertising in there, blah blah blah. That's not the way to go with it, because it's not going to solve the problem that those on the left, or those even on the center left, have with the BBC. It's just going to make it 10 times worse. So, you know, we need to completely revolutionize the BBC, how it's funded, how it's constructed, and all these different things. But, you know, allowing it to become the next Fox News, GB News, whatever you want to call it, is not going to help anybody.
Yeah, it needs to be reclaimed. No, so
exactly. Bad. Right.
When I was wee, the BBC was hailed as some of the best journalism across the world, like some of the reporting, so like that is where you got your news. And when you think back to my ma's generation as well, where you got the BBC on the radio and that was your only source of information, so it had to be really reflective of the people or it wouldn't survive. Whereas now what I think's happening is thinking about the World Service and how important that is for, you know, situations abroad, especially with what's happening in Kazakhstan, what's happening over in Ukraine. And yeah, the World Service is reporting it, but the BBC that we get pumped straight into our living rooms, that's no bringing it up much. So I think it's very much like it's an editorial thing.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm concerned, it's very much an editorial thing.
But also culturally as well in this country, that we need to be given the tools to be able to observe media and be critical of it. And there's so much privilege that comes with being able to see that, right? Because time and effort and understanding and all these different things that a lot of people don't have time to engage with, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, again, a ploy from the free marketeers and the new liberals to get people to work as much so they don't have time to consider anything else. So it's about us people being educated from state school level to engage with things critically and not take things at face value, you know. And it's something that I've been really fortunate to have, like going to university and doing my master's and research and things like that, that it really gives you an opportunity to understand and engage with things critically and just not take things at face value. And it, you know, because sometimes when you look at like some of the tabloids, like, you know, the horrible, the Scum and the Express, all these different things, and it's like, imagine like just taking that at face value and that's what you take as gospel. And it's about understanding, well, the money that's behind that, the conservative leanings that's in that, and the self-interest of the Murdoch press, that, you know, we're reading things with so many lenses in front of them that we need to take a step back and think, you know, is that going to be in my interest to believe what that person's got to say? No. And that is just where we need to engage with media in general in this country, and people should be given the time, the resources and the education to be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the BBC just needs to get back to basics.
Mm-hmm.
It has to get back to doing what it was built for and what it's meant for. It's trying to, I don't see why it tries to compete with commercial channels on their terms. Like, and then we end up situations where licence money is going to pay Graham Norton millions of pounds. And you're like, okay, maybe his talk show is getting good views, but I'm pretty sure you can let him go and get millions of pounds for another station and just bring in another comedian and pay them, somebody that's looking for their start, and pay them a more reasonable salary. I don't see why they need to pay, you know, Gary Lineker like £2.5 million a year when they could be investing that and investing it in the things that are neglected by commercial broadcasters. There's not a lot of money in having a bureau in Kabul or a reporting bureau in somewhere in Africa. So if the BBC's not, you know, going to invest in that infrastructure, who is? Fox News, aren't they going to do it? You know, a lot of these other commercial broadcasters probably won't do it either. You know, and that's what the BBC should be getting back to. And I'd like to see that. I could support, I could get behind that kind of BBC. But the BBC as it stands, the BBC that seems to be chasing clickbait, seems to want to spit in your face if you're if you support Scottish independence or if you're left of Genghis Khan, you know, that's not a BBC I can really, I find it hard, as much as the really good points that have been made here about public service broadcasting, I find it hard to make that argument to help to stand up for the BBC to people, because it's done nothing but spit in their face for years.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's a shame. It's a shame.
It is a real shame. And exactly what you're saying, it's so hard to defend the BBC as it is at the moment, but we can still back the principle of it.
Yeah.
Our sponsor this week is Sense of Nature Pet Service, based in central Scotland. Sense of Nature gives you a hands-on, personalised experience with a variety of exciting creatures, from snakes and skunks to tarantulas and turtles. Sense of Nature has something for everyone. They offer sensory sessions, one-to-one and group sessions, educational encounters for children of all ages, and they are available for private events upon inquiry. Animal welfare is at the forefront of everything they do, and if appropriate, a risk assessment can be carried out at no additional cost prior to your booking. To get 5% off your next booking with Sense of Nature, quote Holyrood Ungagged 5 at time of booking. To contact Sense of Nature, you can do so by email on sense.of.natureinquiries@outlook.com. You can also find them on most social media platforms by searching for Sense of Nature.
Okay, so we're talking about Labour next.
Okay. Favourite topic.
Yay.
So what is happening with the Labour Party these days? And most recently, they accepted the defection of a Tory MP, Christian Wakeford, MP for Bury South, who has voted for stricter asylum system, voted against measures to prevent climate change, and is strongly against greater devolution to Scotland and Wales. So he is welcome now in the Labour Party. But Jeremy Corbyn is still not able to be a Labour MP. And it has also been recently suggested that Corbyn may eventually form his own party. So, Brian, what's going on with Labour?
Well, I don't know. You could probably just cut to any of the podcasts that we've done over the last year and you'll get a nice overview of what I think about Labour and particularly Scottish Labour. But I think there was something really weird about that day when the Bury South MP decided to go from Tory to Labour, with having that stance on certain things, particularly the union, something to bear in mind. And then, you know, he comes into the house, I've defected, big drama, all the Labour cheering, waving their papers, like, what is this 1980? Who's even using the paper anymore? They should be using their phones, you know what I mean? Like, come on.
iPads.
And then he sits directly behind Keir Starmer, looking like, you know, like kind of menacing with a massive Union Jack mask on, and I was like, how fitting is this? Like, that's literally every time you see Keir Starmer making any sort of speech, there's a nice Union Jack flag behind him, just like the Tories. But I think one of the key things I want to talk about, particularly with the defection, is that this MP in Bury South only won by 700 votes. Okay, so there could be a little bit of self-serving going on here, possibly. This guy, you know, speaking so passionately on the media about how he's always been a Tory and blah, 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 and, you know, how much he loved his party and all these different things. And it's just so sad, you know, he can't be in his own party anymore. It's nothing to do with the fact that the Tories have just plummeted about, you know, 16, 17 points in the polls and he's in a very marginal seat. But I think the saddest thing about that defection is that you've got, you know, a candidate who would have stood and fought for Labour in that seat. I don't know how many times this individual has stood and you know, to contest the seat. And now you've got somebody who's literally been elected as a Tory, decided to join the Labour Party, and then will likely to stand again as the MP for that seat if there's another general election, so he can secure his seat again with a party that's more likely to win. And that candidate who would have stood before has just been shoved out of the way. So that is just with that one particular example, is pretty horrific.
Imagine being an activist in Bury South, a Labour Party activist in Bury South.
Yeah, did you see that tweet they'd put out? I think it was last year about the you know, the cuts to universal credit and all these types of things, basically slagging off this Tory MP, and now it's them. That's their representative. And there was a poll done by YouGov where basically they believe that, you know, the public strongly supports that if anybody defects to another party or leaves a party, there should automatically be a by-election, which I completely agree should be the case. I don't think that politicians elected as a party should be able to jump and be in any party that they choose. And then you get the usual bullshit about, well, they vote for the candidate. No, they didn't. They don't. They vote for the party. There will be a smaller majority of people who actually have got the time and the effort and the access to research the candidate, contact the candidate, all these types of things. But generally, people vote for parties, right? Because that's just how parliamentary democracy in this country is presented. Okay, you've got, you know, in England, you've got two choices, or maybe a Lib Dem, and then in Scotland, you've got SNP, Labour, Tory, right? That's just how the system works. You vote for the party. You very rarely vote for the candidate. So there's that. And I'll let Deborah speak because she's getting awfully excited there with her phone. And then I'll come back to it more wider about Labour Party and the whole Jeremy Corbyn debacle.
Yeah, I was just looking at Bury South Labour Party Twitter.
Yes.
And
yay.
They seem to have been on an absolute PR campaign,
uh-huh,
out stomping the streets with them. Christian Wakefield is the new MP. I think it's interesting if you scroll back through it, because they were slagging the parties back in December, you know, the Tory parties. And then in January, they retweeted that Christian Wakeford. So, and then they were just out in the streets with him. So it's interesting. I wonder what's been going on behind the scenes there. Because as you say, if you were that Labour candidate, you would be royally pissed off. Like, you'd be like, why have we got a Tory coming here and just fought against him? And he says he's a centrist, right? So obviously he's going to be like, aye, come on, pal, come on, join the centrist bus. But he's not, is he?
No, he's not.
He's got his right wingery. I'm surprised Labour folk are standing for it. And I also see there's been a few calls for a by-election in Bury. So we'll see how that goes.
That is a proverbial rat leaving the proverbial sinking ship.
It is. I don't know. I always think that constituents deserve better. I don't think politics should be like football teams where you, mm-hmm, have to support one party for the, you know, your whole entire life, because politics is dynamic and things change. So I don't have a problem with people changing their minds. What they have a wee bit of a problem with is democracy. Like, how democratic is that for him? Like, the people, as you say, it was 700 votes that got him in, but these 700 votes are still a democratic choice. How are they going to feel if they're, you know, we voted for the Tories? I hate sticking up for the Tories. I want all the Tories to leave. I'd want them to be a Tory party. I'd rather all our arguments were about process and how to make this a more, mm-hmm, socially just country, rather than us arguing all the time about, can we stop being so extremely right-wing? Because that's what we are. But
that's the name of the
Labour
podcast.
Folk are like, I think we should be a wee bit less left. It's like, no, just stop it. Just stop. Stoked all of this. I would rather that we were arguing about, oh, we're too centrist than we're too fucking right wing. That's my two cents on it. I don't even know if that made any sense.
I mean, it's kind of like, you know, like, you want to be arguing, you know, positively, and a lot of time we're fighting a kind of defensive action, saying, can you please not starve these children?
Yeah.
That's, you know, we're really, it's a bit of an outlier here. That's the least that we're looking for, is let's not starve children.
Yeah.
Let's not have people drowning.
Let's not let people drown in the fucking sea.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're at, people.
That's exactly where we're at. And
where we are, in their centrist values these days, apparently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, looking at the Labour Party and is there going to be a split, blah, blah, blah. Well, no, I don't think there will be a split in Labour.
Independence for Scottish Labour, that's what I want.
I don't know what independence is, mate. But when it comes to Labour, it's like, you know, Labour is as split as you want, because you can talk about we're a broad church and we like to listen to different people's perspectives, all that nonsense that you get. Well, actually, the Labour Party should be about three or four different parties, okay? And it probably would be in a real representative democracy where you've got loads of different parties that stand on various manifestos and commitments, and then you basically create a coalition with all these parties like they do in Germany, where they've got three parties that work together. So maybe if we didn't have the shit first past the post system, the Labour, mm-hmm, Party wouldn't be split, because the Labour Party wouldn't exist in its actual form, and we would actually maybe have loads of different parties putting more progressive ideas across, where we don't just happen to, you know, choose the blue party or the red party, who, mm-hmm, apparently, based on this Tory MP who's just joined the party, exactly, that basically doesn't actually make much of a difference. I think what that Christian actually said was, you know, basically, I'm still a centrist, I'll just be wearing a different rosette. That's literally what he said. And it's like, right, that's horrifying. That is absolutely horrifying. That our choices, what New Labour done, which was like, you know, really, really horrible things where they were playing the working class off against each other, benefit fraud, benefit street, mm-hmm, all that shite.
Immigration controls.
Exactly, all these immigration controls, but what they might just happen to fund public services a little bit better than the Tories. Is that the best that we can do?
Keir Hardie rolling over in his grave.
Literally.
I could see an argument. See if there'd been a Tory MP for decades, and they was now saying the modern Tory party is went so right wing, it has left me behind. I've no changed my views. The Tory party's, you know, changed theirs. That's why I feel I'm more in line with Labour now. Mm-hmm. He became an MP in 2019. Is mm-hmm. he trying to say, did he know what the Tories were about in 2019?
I think I always get really annoyed actually about that sort of perspective as well. That if Tories have been with the party for years and years and years, I mean, it's like, is it Ken Clark? He's one that's sort of reevaluated himself as being like this sort of like, oh, I'm an old Tory. You know, the Tories just have just left me. Like, they're so right wing, blah, blah, blah. You served under Thatcher, who basically demonised queer people. Get to fuck. Like, I really, it's like, oh, it's the party's left me. What? Honestly, I find that bizarre. It's
self-preservation, that's what I think.
Exactly.
You know, remember, crossing the floor with all the, all that theatre performance in the chamber. How are we living in a modern democracy, really? See, when you saw that, as you say, all the drama when he crossed the floor, it's self-preservation, as you say, rat leaving a sinking ship.
So yeah. From somebody who was welcomed into the Labour Party to somebody who has been forcibly kept out,
mm-hmm.
What do you think is Corbyn's future? Do you think he is going to end up launching his own party?
What do you think, Deborah?
I don't know. I like Jeremy Corbyn.
I like Corbyn as well.
Yeah, I think it would be a good party. But I'd worry that it was, you know, sort of ridiculed as a breakaway thing and it wouldn't be taken seriously. Whereas it could be a great platform for, you know, to enact change that could pressurise the Labour Party. Will he do it? I don't know. Would he? What do you think?
Under normal circumstances, I don't think Corbyn would dream of doing that. He was an MP all through the New Labour times.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he was a constant rebel, but
mm-hmm.
he never tried to break away or feel Labour then. You know, he's a Labour person.
He's quite principled, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so.
But the situation now is he's a Labour Party member, but he's not a Labour mm-hmm. MP because they won't let him be. And I don't see that changing while Starmer's in charge, in which case, unless Starmer leaves before the next election, which I think would take something completely out of left field that we've not seen coming to take him out.
A birthday party.
Oh, he crosses party, the floor. would we notice? But the point is, at the next general election, if Corbyn is not a Labour MP, he'll either have to stand down as an MP, which I don't think he wants to do, or he'll be automatically expelled if he tries to run as an independent. So there's a kind of ticking clock on this. And I think, reluctantly, I think that Corbyn will choose to stay in Parliament to represent his constituents rather than, you know, just walk away in order to still be a Labour member.
I hope he does. I don't think he's going to get readmitted as a Labour MP under the current leadership. I think that this is Keir Starmer's sort of like message to centrists out there saying, you know, Corbyn was a mistake, Labour was too far left, that problem's gone, so you can come back to us now because we're back to being like Tony Blair again, so we're cool Britannia. Yeah, all that shite. I think that's where we're kind of at with Keir Starmer's Labour. But yeah, you're right with the ticking clock because, yeah, as soon as he says, I'm going to stand as an independent, he'll be expelled for the party. And I think for him, that would be more important to represent his constituency. And I really hope, excuse me, that he does stand. I think it would be great to see him stand in his constituency, even if it's an independent or under the banner of the Peace and Justice Project. I don't think that the party should necessarily expand beyond that at the moment, because under the first past the post, it could be really disastrous for them. And that's horrendous, because we've seen like the Green Party not be able to break through in the first past the post system, despite getting, you know, higher and higher percentage of the vote. That's just the way the first past the post system set up, and it's designed that way. It's, you know, by calculation to prevent smaller parties from breaking through. And I really hope that Jeremy Corbyn stands in his constituency. He gets a lot of support, grassroots support, you know, people from across the left going to his constituency to really try and get him elected. And I think it would be fantastic to see him win the seat over Labour.
Is there in England a sort of, you know, how we have the Scottish Cooperative Party that is sort of under an umbrella of Labour? Does England have that? Do you know?
Good question.
I don't know if the Cooperative Party is strictly a Scottish thing or if it's an England too.
I think it's a wider thing.
Because could he not stand up under that and then still...
He would still be running against whoever Labour mm-hmm. decider is going to put up.
Yeah.
So if he runs against a Labour candidate, he'll be expelled.
That's a shame. That's what Labour's become. Labour's become the Tory sanctuary.
So it seems.
But I mean, if he's going to run as an independent, then you know he might as well register it as a register a party. And
what would he call his party? What do you think the Corbyn party would be called?
Well, there's speculation that I think he has a charity,
the Peace and Justice Project.
Peace and Justice. So there's speculation that he would register that as a party, which is a nice name, actually.
That's great, and I think. But what the Peace and Justice Project actually does is obviously it's not essentially a political party, but there's people who speak of that, like some of the left on. In Labour, so like Zara Sultana, for example, has been involved in some of the events that they run because...
Is it like a think tank?
It's not a think tank. It's more like a sort of... Basically like a charity, basically. And basically promoting peace and justice, which I think is great. Yeah. Like, how can you get behind that? How can you attack
what
that?
What a monster.
Exactly. What an absolute...
Peace and justice. How greedy is the man?
Basically, yeah. I hope Corbyn wins these... wins Islington North as an independent or as part of his new party. And I think it would be great to watch that general election and watch him beat the Labour Party. I think it would be amazing. And it could happen. I genuinely think it could happen.
But what I think Corbyn would walk into his own constituency. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I'd be shocked if he didn't win it. I think, though, if you register a party, you could run somebody next door as basically the Corbyn candidate, and the candidate next door, the constituent next door, is Keir Starmer's.
Yeah.
You've coined a media phrase there that's going to be Corbyn candidates.
It could conceivably be a left-wing version of UKIP. You know, UKIP basically took over the Tories.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the Tory party completely completely capitulated to everything UKIP stood for and wanted. If Labour suddenly had to start panicking, a lot of these, you know, MPs, Labour MPs that are effectively just like looking after their own interests, at the moment that means going to the right all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were suddenly worrying about bleeding votes to, you know, a Corbyn-backed candidate to the left, they would have to recalculate a lot of these things. I think it's quite an interesting prospect. Usually I would say, as you kind of touched on earlier, people vote for the party, not the candidate. Every time, just about, we see a sitting MP decide they're going to run as an independent, they usually get absolutely embarrassed. Destroyed. But I think Corbyn could be the exception to that.
I would totally agree with that, because is it not David Gawk stood as an independent, didn't he, after he left the Tories in that last general election and got absolutely annihilated? And you had that independence group, and is it the independent group? Remember them?
Change UK
or whatever they were called, the Independence for Change or whatever. It finally decided to become before the general election. They got completely washed away. You know,
closer to home as well. You can see Alex Salmond. Got absolutely destroyed.
Yeah, and it's only a matter of time for these sitting ALBA MPs that defected. They've got no hope in hell of retaining their seats, and that's going to be a good thing to see. But I do agree, because I know that I was making the point quite vehemently earlier about the, you know, people voting for a party, and you know, you would vote more for the party, and I think that's true to an extent. But I do believe that Corbyn could be the one to kind of break that mold a little bit. If there was a good grassroots campaign, you know, I think he definitely could take it, and it would be great to see.
You know, and then you could have strategically placed candidates, you know, taking on right-wing Labour MPs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wouldn't run somebody against the likes of Diane Abbott or John mm-hmm. McDonnell, so it would become in a Labour party's, a Labour MP's interest to be associated with the left, because it would insulate themselves against that attack.
It's interesting. I'd never really thought about it that way, because this is what, if you think about the Brexit Party and Reform or whatever they're called now, in the last general election agreed to stand down, didn't they, against the Tory candidates when they said, you know, if you're going to say you'll get Brexit done now, which is all they essentially cared about, they withdrew all those candidates from the seats so the Tories could get the votes. So ultimately it's playing the first past the post system against itself, basically, where you're becoming a party that, you know, might take 5 to 10% of a vote in any constituency, which would actually be enough to probably change the outcome for either the Labour candidate or the Tory candidate. So it is really quite interesting.
I've also seen as well, like, the launch of the Northern Independence Party,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of playing on a Northern identity that exists. Mm-hmm. And it is a sort of thing that's been neglected, that there is potential there for a party like that to get some kind of purchase. Corbyn could probably run as a sort of London party. A lot of his closest allies are all London MPs as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if there's a room for that, and we could all come at the Westminster establishment for that sort of route, the Scots and the Welsh and the,
would it be great?
The Northerners and the Londoners all rising up together.
I think the Scousers and the Manx, that'd be good.
I really
want somebody to get that Avengers Endgame portal scene and then just like redo it with all the
leaders of all these
regions and nation.
I love that. It's important to say about the Northern Independence Party, though, that was, I can't remember what by-election that they were being really like sort of spoken about a lot, and they were like, you know, high profile, we're gonna, you know, do really well, and they were polling quite high. It's really gonna bug me now where that was, that really famous by-election that the Tories won. Basically the Northern Independence Party and that high profile by-election only won 2% of the vote. So it's just important to put that in context when, you know, these parties that are kind of born on social media and you know, get a lot of following and things like that sometimes don't get the sort of payback.
Hartlepool,
that's it. Hartlepool. That's
from
the
small
one.
Seeds do mighty oaks grow.
Aye. No one to first past the post, did any?
So Lorna Slater was accused of being a diva recently. A Hollywood diva, she was branded, because she didn't want to work every day of COP26. This was after an email was leaked, which showed Lorna laying down her boundaries that she wanted 2 days off during the 14 days of COP26, about how many events she wanted to attend during the day. And apparently that means she was, I think, lazy was another word that was used, mm-hmm. and a Hollywood diva. Thoughts, Deborah?
Oh, heaven forbid we promote working less. Oh, it's just really infuriated me, and it's very pertinent to my own situation where I've just started a job in politics. And I only work 9.5 hours, and I am pretty maxed out at 9.5 hours a week. That is, by the way, I know some people do that as a whole shift. Very sorry, but I'm disabled and I have limitations within my physical abilities as well as my cognitive abilities. And I'm not sure, is Lorna? Lorna's neurodiverse, isn't she?
She is.
These requests are completely and utterly within, you know, the equalities guidelines anyway of being employed. So the response to it was the response that really got my fucking back up, because it was totally ableist.
Mm-hmm.
It was, in many aspects, misogynistic as well. And it was just ridiculous. Like, really, who wants to work 14 days in a row? Do you? Do you want
no.
to? Like, I know, David, sometimes you have to do some no nice shifts in the care sector.
I don't think I've ever done 14 days and I wouldn't.
And I know in the restaurant industry as well, Brian, mm-hmm, which you are in, there's often, you know, working late on earlies and no getting a day off at the weekend. So, but I don't think what Lorna requested was, you know, it wasn't unreasonable.
And it's okay.
My voice went higher and higher.
And then you know where to go. And then she goes a little bit like, I can't work. No, like exactly what you're saying, and just echoing the ableist perspective, the misogyny that was coming out of it. But you know what? It's not even just necessarily misogyny. It was the macho-ness. And I think this is really specific here. It's like, well, what, you're not even going to work 14 days during a green climate conference and you call yourself a green? Well, if I was a green, I'd be doing this. And that's the basis of where this started. Mm-hmm. And I cannot remember for the life of me what, was it Colin Smith, Labour MSP, who was starting this?
Yeah. A lot of this was coming, this seemed to be coming from Scottish Labour quite a lot.
Yes.
Most of the attack lines I saw was Labour people pushing it.
Yeah. And some of the responses to that was really, really funny, and it made me laugh, was, you know, being in Scottish Labour, where working 14 days is good, actually. You know, it's like, this is really where we're at. The trade union movement fought hard for us to work 14 days in a row. Like, this is literally like Scottish Labour, who've meant to be the trade union, you know, representation within mainstream politics, meant to be, and who support people that are disabled, people, you know, women in politics, all the stuff that they should be doing. And they actually just produced this absolute mess themselves and amplified this. And of course, who else was doing that? the Tories. Yeah. So basically, it was the Conservatives and it was the Tories. Even the Lib Dems basically supported what Lorna was asking for. And it's so ridiculous when you think about that. Somebody didn't want to attend hundreds of events, and she, Lorna Slater, did not want to work 14 days. Like, that is it. And these are perfectly reasonable requests, like, if for anybody, any worker, mm-hmm. to make. Yeah. And we shouldn't expect more from our politicians. We shouldn't. And people are always like, oh, you know, people should be doing X, Y, and Z because they're elected members and stuff like that. Well, yeah, they commit to doing a job. They commit to representing their constituents, but they've still got social lives. They still have personal needs. They still need support, particularly if you're neurodiverse or you're disabled. I just think it's such a bizarre argument to start, where it's almost like, you know, Scottish Labour went for another gotcha on the Scottish Greens, and then, you know, they're going to keep going because it was getting a reaction, and then they turn around and the only people supporting them is the Tories, and they're just like, ha ha, we're just going to keep going because this is a great look for us.
It's almost like the Greens have now been promoted in Labour's eyes as being in the same category as the SNP.
Yes.
In terms of, they will throw out any principle they have into the bin if it means taking a swing at their enemies. And it's like, you know, oh, we stand for labour rights and stuff like that, but we'll absolutely trample all over them if it gives the chance to throw some mud at our political opponents.
We're the party that fought for the weekend, but how? Oh, no anymore.
If you're a Scottish Green.
But no, every week.
I know, every week. a fortnight end. It's just, it is really ridiculous. And it's funny that you said that, like, they do now just attack the Greens the same way that they attack the SNP for no reason, you know, like, oh, the SNP introduced the child disability payment and the Labour were attacking them, like, oh, why are you not giving them more? And it's like, well, I don't know, maybe it's somebody with the Tories that you should really be attacked. I do think that the whole, how, you know, the importance that is put on working, like, and you've got, yes, to work really hard and everything, you know, I hate that. I really hate that. That is not what life should be about. You should work because you're really, like, if you're in politics, you should be really passionate about doing it and you should want to give it your all. And I think Lorna does that. I think Lorna is quite clearly really committed to the green values and, you know, serving the Scottish government and serving our constituents. And I don't think anything was unreasonable. The ableism, though, that's what really got my fucking back up. That was, I was gross. It was really gross. And it was really disheartening to a female who is just getting into it, you know, into politics as a sort of career. That was like, oh my God, what if I have to have some time off? It's not attractive for people who want to get into politics. Like, maybe you've got caring responsibilities, mm-hmm. maybe you've got childcare, maybe you're studying. And with the local elections coming up as well, it was very telling, I think, for mm-hmm. For Labour candidates, and you should be making sure that if you're voting for Labour, you should be asking the candidates, how do you feel about how Scottish Labour reacted to this? Because I wouldn't want to go into council and be expected to work the sort of hours. I wouldn't want to go into Holyrood and be expected to work these sort of hours. So who are they attracting in that sort of role? Maniacs that want to do a 24/7 hour job day? Like, mm-hmm. does anybody want to do that?
And it's also the fact that you're likely to be attacked for something as unreasonable as,
yep.
you don't want to work every single day. I mean, certainly from my perspective, like, local elections coming up,
mm-hmm.
I feel it's been a lot harder to find people to stand candidates than mm-hmm. it was four or five years ago.
Yep.
The last election, and it's going to be particularly female candidates, it's really difficult to find.
Which we need because as well. We need more female candidates.
And this has just been the latest, you know. I think in the last podcast we did, we were talking about another woman politician that was under attack and getting dragged through the front pages, like, for nothing, for doing for something quite reasonable. But it always seems to be women that get attacked for mm-hmm. these things a lot more than men.
Well, not just women, minorities. The diversity that we actually need in politics mm-hmm. is not going to be attracted when the discourse is like this. Like,
absolutely.
Need to get a grip
of themselves. I totally agree with that. And I think it's particularly important where if we do have people who are disabled, we have people who have been dependent on the welfare system to actually communicate it articulately and clearly. And this is why, you know, we were talking about the cost of living and labour and things earlier. It's like Jack Munro speaks so yes. well about living in poverty and all these different things because they've experienced it, they've entrenched it. And you know what? They may not be in that position anymore, but they lived it, they understand understand it, and they would be able to help bring clear view to that, and then actually make meaningful changes to policy. So having people that have lived in poverty, people who have been reliant on the welfare state, people who are disabled, queer people, trans people, people of colour, these are the types of people that need to be coming forward, but they're the people that have been excluded because of white men's actions, and basically just spilling out absolute crap. And just another thing that I wanted to pick on from what you were saying there, Deborah, about the focus on hard work, but then it always comes down to hard paid work. So it's not about emotional labor or caregiving or anything like that. But I just want to obviously point to, and Labour are kind of falling down this trap, and Tories have just moved well right of this, but you know, when they talk about hard-working families, hard-working British families, that's like subtle cues. And if you say hard-working, well, what do you mean? People that work two or three jobs because they can't afford to live on the wages that they're being provided from one or even two jobs. Are you talking about people who are unable to work because they're disabled? Are you talking about people who are unable to work because they're a single parent? Are you talking about people who are unable to work because they've chosen to, you know, study or just personally have chosen, I'm not going to be a slave to running about and working 40 hours a week, because there's people that are privileged enough to be able to do that, but they don't make them any less of a person or any less of a family because they decide not to buy into, you know, having to run ragged so that you can have, you know, a consumerist lifestyle. So it's really interesting that the focus always falls on hardworking families, because that's trying to capture the people who are trapped in this capitalist system who have to keep working, you know. And I always find that particular phrase fascinating, and excludes so many people, particularly minorities.
It also puts all the focus on money, earning money, because the focus then is earning as much money as you can and working as many hours possible to maximise how much money. I'd never really cared about earning loads of money. I just want to earn enough money, and if I can do that, be working 35 hours, fine. If I can do it by working 30 hours, even better. If I can do it by working 5 hours, that's fantastic. I would rather do that. I would rather work as little as possible to get, you know, a level of money that is enough, and then do things like this podcast or the political work, you know, do things that I care about rather than you know, having to do something for hours every week because, well, if you don't, you'll not have anywhere to stay or anything to eat, you know. It's upside down.
For Labour to have come out with some of the comments that they did, it was so disheartening, because it's like they've abandoned all their values of fair work, fair pay, and they've, as you say, they themselves have crossed the lobby onto the Tory side. It's no fair, and the attitudes of that work hard, work hard, work hard, that's one of the very fundamental problems of the social security system. Because when I went to them and said, oh, I want to go back to work, they said, we're not asking you to go to work, because I was a deserving pauper. I was disabled, I was deserving, which is ridiculous when you actually think about it. For Labour to, you know, sort of piggyback on that sort of ideology, it's actually quite mind-blowing. And all Lorna did ask was she didn't want to work so much, which should be a fundamental human fucking default.
And everyone should be able to, everyone should have that ingrained in them, saying, do you know what, you shouldn't have to work overtime. You shouldn't have to work 39 hours a week in this day and age, because, you know, looking at historical fights from the trade union where they managed to reduce the working days from 7 to 6 to 5, like, we should continue on that journey. You know, the four-day week is obviously becoming accepted in the mainstream. Okay, interesting. That could be a podcast in itself, because I've got loads to say about that. But at the same time, it's about, like, how do we completely liberate people from having to work as the biggest time of their week? I just don't understand why we don't want to be that, because you'll be lazy otherwise, because, you know, society, you won't be deserving of, you know, that house or that car or whatever it is you've got, because you don't work hard enough for it. I worked hard for this, is one of the things that people get so proud about saying. And remember, even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, so many people would be like, well, I worked 60 hours last week, I'm a hard worker and stuff like that. Mate, again, you've been duped. You've been absolutely duped. Why is that something to be proud of? Why do you, you know, I'm going to work for two or three different companies doing, you know, currying because, you know, because I'm such a hard worker. Look at me. It's great. Let's just stop this. Like, stop this nonsense and let's get back on the quest for reducing work to give people more time to do things that they care about, to engage with things that they care about, and ultimately learn and be better, more content people. Because that's what you're aiming for.
One of the ways to achieve that is just by employers being more flexible, more accommodating for their staff, and expecting less of them. Like, that's the real simple way of doing it. And that's all that Lorna was making the point of.
And there we are.
On that note, thanks again, guys, for joining us. Thanks to everybody out there for listening. So we've got a good article up on the website this week from Guy Ingerson about the increase in renewables from the Scottish Government. So if you want to read that, go on to leftungagged.org. We've got a new monthly podcast that's been running now called From the Ungagged Collective. It's from the other side of the Atlantic. It's called World Beat with George Collins. And he'll be interviewing scholars, activists and writers from about the state of the world. We also might have another podcast in the works. Stay tuned for that. And if there's anything you want us to talk about in Holyrood Ungagged, you can tweet us at _ungagged, #HollyroodUngagged, or drop us an email at ungaggedleft@gmail.com, putting Holyrood Ungagged in the subject line. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please go to whatever platform that you listen to on and give us a 5-star review. Again, guys, thanks for joining us, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.